Some of you might have met Lawrence in Thiruvannamalai at the retreat, where I had invited him to give a talk on his book, When You Die. I met Lawrence a year ago at the 2025 retreat, which he attended, and he gifted me his book, which he had self-published. And when I read it, I felt books of this nature need to be made available to people, because the only certainty in life is death, and yet we shy away from it. So I read the book when I got back from the 2025 retreat, and there were two passages in it which struck me as being very close in spirit to the teachings of Advaita, which I'd like to read out and then hand it over to Lawrence to speak a bit about his book and himself, and also what drew him to the Thiruvannamalai retreat the first time. And then you may ask your questions to him as long as time permits. So I will have a nice rest today in satsang. Can you all hear me, or should I speak a bit louder? Okay. What makes things worse is that the wise beings and God also threw in something called free will. This means that although you have designed your birth and death and everything that happens in between yourself, you will be under the illusion that you can make choices in life based on the influence of random people you meet, as well as that negative voice in your head, rather than using your gut feel and common sense. Your free will could unfortunately steer you off your life path completely. Your destiny still stays the same though. What you also don't know is that if you manage to figure out what you are supposed to do on earth and thus live and actually follow your predetermined life path, you will be happy in life. If not, you will become unhappy. Thanks to God's input, the plan is designed in a way that you are always supposed to be happy while on earth. Happiness is thus your yardstick that will show you how close you are to living your life path towards that predetermined destiny. The other passage. One of the most important lessons that can be learned in life is to realize what and who you really are. That awareness is called self-realization. When self-realization happens, self-love happens by default. An alchemist is someone who is self-realized. The elixir that is needed to change so-called lead into gold, or rather to change from human being to heavenly being, while still alive on earth, is the feeling called love. It is through understanding that self-love happens. Understanding here is referred to as jnana. It is through self-love that love for others happens. It is through that love that life happens, and it is through that kind of life that heaven happens. You become an alchemist the day you realize that you are that bright electric white light with a glittering diamond inside. You then start loving yourself, and the more you learn to love yourself, the more love you will be able to radiate out to others. So you see, this teaching most of you are familiar with speaks about not the dualistic love, which is the opposite of hate, but what could be referred to as transcendental love. An acknowledgement that consciousness is all there is, and through those who love you and through those who have troubled you, it is the same consciousness which functions. So the sage's love is a misunderstood love, because the sage loves everyone equally. Nobody is made to feel more special than anyone else. But this is the love which self-realization bestows. This is the love of consciousness, because there is only one consciousness, there is only one self, which appears as two, which is the Maya, because life is about relationships. But what we forget is that our relationships are the relationship of the one self. But the Maya is so strong that when we come and stand before the mirror, instead of seeing ourselves, we see others. And these others, we scale and grade. Those who have praised me, said nice things to me, loved me, and those who have harmed me and hurt me. This is the realm of duality, and we are stuck in this dualism because we have split up the one source consciousness between the polarities of love and hate. Now, what I got from this book, because Lawrence has written it in a fictionalized way, so it's easier to absorb, because it's some very heavy material in there, is that, as this teaching says, if you learn to live a life of peace, equanimity, and calm, and a total acceptance of the will of God, and that nobody is the doer of their actions, including myself, then you will be prepared to die. It is the way we live and how much we are willing to die day by day to our judgments, views, opinions, that a peaceful death is ensured. So now I will request Lawrence to take over and share his words with you. Lawrence.
Thank you, Gautam. Thank you. It's a great honor for me to be here. I've been in India for a month now, and I traveled all the way, and I've written it down because of the pronunciation of the places. Chittambaram.
Chidambaram.
Chidambaram. From Chidambaram down in the far south, up to Dwarka in the west, I've been to various places, had tremendous experiences. From doing the Giruvallam, arrived in Tiruvannamalai on full moon without it being planned. Didn't do it once, didn't do it twice, did it three times just to make sure. Right through to going to Madanapalli, where I wasn't only in the presence of Sri M, who's somebody I follow in that aura of him, but it just so happened that Mother Meera was in town as well. So I could, for those who know, have two of these people at the same time in these spaces. Right through to going to Girnar, where on the day that Chinese New Year happened and Ramadan started and the festival of the palms in Christianity started, that all happened to happen in within the same 24 hour period. I was sitting meditating on top of Girnar. So many miracles, and then on to Somnath and Dwarka and Trimbakeshwar and Shirdi, and I was everywhere to end up here. To share with you that if you understand Advaita, if you understand Gautama's teachings, you will have absolutely nothing to fear about death. And I'm prepared to say there's a very high possibility that you will probably die in your sleep. No struggling in those last moments or months and all that kind of stuff. All you need to know is Advaita, peacefulness, oneness, and you will be okay. So, now, I am from South Africa, and you may wonder, what is this African doing in a dhoti, talking about Hindu and Indian philosophy? So I just want to give you a quick, big background of who I am and why I say that. If you die, or when you die, you are not dead. There is no such thing as death. We never die. You won't die. You only transition into a different plane of existence. It is going from the awakened state to the dream state, exactly the same thing. Dying is like falling asleep. There's absolutely no difference. If you do it right, can be very different, but if you do it right, if you are peaceful at the time, it's simply like falling asleep and going into a dream state. Only difference is the dream state lasts so much longer. And then you wake up again in another body through reincarnation. And if you've done a good enough job, you don't wake up in another body and you go straight up to moksha. You move on. So it's really as simple as that. There's nothing to fear about death. But now, how do I know this? I was an executive director of a company, highly stressed, ended up discovering reflexology and aromatherapy as a way to relieve stress. I was so interested, I started studying it. I became an aromatherapist and reflexologist. And while I was doing that as a hobby on the side, I realized that colors started popping out of the people I was working on. And I started hearing voices about people that turned out to be of value to them. So I later only found out what I was seeing was auras and chakras, and I'm supposed to be clairvoyant and clairaudient and clairsentient and clair everything. It was just there. I didn't need to do any sudden or nothing. Probably in past lifetime or many lifetimes, but I was the executive that just knew all these things. And my visions were profound. Like, for instance, let me give you this example. And this is for therapists, just by the way. Your mind affects your aura in a great, great way. Because I found when I look at people, and yes, I can see auras, when I look at people, and I see their auras, I see it looks like a certain way. But the moment they find out I can see auras, that aura changes. Most of them go gold. Now, there's no such thing as a golden aura. It's an ego saying, oh, well, you can see my aura, it must, you know, be gold. It changes. So when you're a therapist and you work with somebody, be careful. What I found in aromatherapy is once I massage a person, they've got an aura color and colors. Once they fall asleep, their aura changes completely and they start showing the true colors. And that is what you want to work with, because that is where the real problems start showing yourself. Otherwise, you're going to heal what they think is wrong with them, and it's not going to be successful. That's just a side note. So here I had this lady come in. I could just sense there was big problems with her. I see stress and anger and resentment and jealousy also as black colors at various parts of the body. So I could just see this girl was full of black stuff, but I couldn't see any black stuff. So I knew she was faking it. She knew I can see her aura. So she had a beautiful aura. Lying on the bed, beautiful aura. She didn't fall asleep. I couldn't break in. Now I've got a technique that if I touch your feet in a certain way at the bottom of your feet, and you do it correctly, it's as if black smoke comes squirting out your feet at the bottom of your feet. It is all your stresses and strains and stuff just come pouring out of you. And I squeezed this goal every way possible. Nothing came out. And I was really perplexed because I knew there must be black stuff in her, and it just got. Next moment, right in front of me, hovering above her body, appeared like what looked like a leather pouch of sorts, rolled up and tied by two little strings. So now this is imaginary. I'm standing, this lady is lying in front of me in a bed. I'm not touching her. This bag is in front of her. I pull on two strings. Thing rolls open, only to see that there's little hatches in there, and in that there was tools kind of thing, like what would look like a knife, a little stick with a stone tied to it, another one had a little brush tied to it, another one was just like a porcupine pig. No idea what it was used for, but instinctively I just pulled out the strong pit. And I walked around imaginary and just boop, boop, poked her feet and outskirted the black star. Now, that is taking imagination to a next level. I mean, if I think this is the first time I'm actually telling the story publicly. People would lock me up in a mental institution if I would tell them that I just take the stick and black stuff comes squirting out your feet. I mean, what kind of guy is this? But the important part is, the moment I picked her feet and the black stuff came squirting out, the patient said, "Wow, what are you doing? I'm feeling as if my troubles are just draining out of me." And that to me was a quantification of what I see is real. It is actually having an effect in the physical body. That person could recognize that. And I have many such stories to tell where I have physically seen evidence of what I see is real, which has given me the confidence, and especially after doing the trip and everything that I've done this time around, to proudly say that what I see, and there's just, I've got absolutely no doubt in that. So, other than just seeing auras and chakras and stuff, I also see dead people. So, people in the spirit world. Seeing that, of course it came as a major shock, and I thought I'd gone mad, and it's taken years for me to make peace with this CD. I thought, okay, well, how many people can see dead people? So I made use of this opportunity, probably as a businessman background, to find out more. So I asked these dead people, so where are you? How did you get there? What did it feel like to die? And I got valuable feedback. And that taught me a lot about the afterlife, what happens, how to get there, and why it is absolutely silly not to fear death whatsoever. Now, what I've learned from these people are that, and yes, the aim is to get to the Pitru Loka, as is, you will all understand that. In the West, they don't, where you've got the 13-day ritual, which I think is fantastic. And if you are traditional, and if you understand that ceremony, I strongly recommend you do it. One cannot argue with ancient texts. It is not always necessary. If you know Advaita and all of that, it is not necessary. You don't have to do it, but if you do it, it is a bonus. Because what happens is, you go from the awakened state. As we all know, we fall asleep every night of our lives. And during that time, your smartwatch will now tell you, you spend so many hours in dream state, so many hours in deep sleep state, and so on. We do exactly the same thing when we die. We spend a certain amount of time in a different plane of existence that feels like a dream, because when you dream, you are in that dream. You are absolutely, everything is so real for you. So when you are dead, you are not dead. You are in another world altogether. Now, what happens is, the moment you leave your body, the run-up to that moment can be traumatic, depending on how it happens, and that depends on how you've lived your life. But once you are out of your body, you feel fantastic. It is so, so good to be dead. I'm truly looking forward to that day. But I think people who's got the ability to see these things also has the wisdom to understand that we are duty-bound. We have got a job to do. So I would love to be dead, but I also know I've got a job to do. So while I'm alive, it needs to be done. So once you are dead, your senses are so much stronger. So if you were fearful in life, you will be petrified in death. If you were loving in life, you will be extremely loving in death. Peaceful in life, super peaceful in death. So it is absolutely important to work on those issues before you die. Not the day or the week when you get that diagnosis that you've got a week to go. That's kind of too late. You need to start now. And you don't know when your time is going to come. So that when you're out of your body, you feel absolutely fantastic. You can see everybody. You can hear everybody. You're there. You want to. If you had a long sick bed, you're up and you, yay, I'm done. I don't know how this happened, but I'm healed. And yet you see people standing around the bed. Now you've dead. You've left your body, crouching over the body, and they're sad. And you think, what's going on? And you push them, kind of try and get to what's going on in the room. And then you realize that's me lying on that body. So you can see that. And that's normally when the shock hits you, that, oh, what just happened? So if you are prepared for death, that shock won't come. You'll know, yay, I'm out of my body. What's the next step? And take that next step. And that is where the death rituals come in, is that should you be shocked and say, oh my, I didn't expect this, which happens often because we never expect to die. The chanting helps to appease you to know, okay, whoa, hang on, there's people. So the people are not crying over the body. They're actually chanting. They're helping me to relax as well. If you then relax, what you can do as well is whatever you think happens. So if your child happens to be in America or Australia or somewhere else, and you think of that child, you will be instantaneously right there with that person in the room. And there's many accounts of people saying, I felt my mother or my dad in the room, and then later on you find out they've just died. So you can do that. But the problem is, if you do that, you can go shopping in Paris as well. So some people really enjoy this idea of you can be where you want to be, and you literally, you can't buy anything and you can't feel or touch anything, but you can be there. But the problem is that a time period of that, there's a limited time that you can play around in the spirit world. And that is where the 13-day process is so effective, because you've basically got 30 days, in my experience, what I've seen. After a 30-day period, everything changes. Your ability to be a free spirit disappears, and you become locked in a loca of sorts, what I call the world of ghosts, where memory goes, everything goes. You get stuck in the final frame of mind that you had just before you died. Now, of many hospitals that I visit, I see people in a spirit world sitting in the corner, and just like that, they could have been there for years. Where the ghost sitting there, not knowing what to do, where to go. It's not a place you want to be. I see children in the ghost world. I had a case where a child was so worried about the parent, the child was basically supporting the parent, small child, supporting the parent that was on drugs and all sorts of stuff. And when the child died, the child was so concerned about the parent, the child didn't want to go to heaven, and rather became the ghost and got stuck in that world. It happens. Various things happen. So you don't want to get stuck in that world. You want to move on. And then when you do move on, you go into what is known the petruloka, the in-between state, where you are a spirit, you are happy, life goes on, and I call it the heavenly suburbs, because you're not quite in heaven, you're not in moksha, it's heavenly suburbs where you can go relax, be, live, until you are ready to come and do a next lifetime and learn more, and through the process of reincarnation, until you understand Advaita, and then you can go straight up. So, in my experience, what happens is that the moment you are outside of your body, and I've seen this with everybody, is a vortex appears above your head. A big, it looks like a whirlwind of light, looks like clouds, that if you look up into this vortex, which is basically a tunnel of clouds, which look like a light when you look at it, lots of people who's done near-death experiences will talk to you, they've seen the light and they've gone into the light and so on. In my experience, it's not a light, it's actually a tunnel. If you look at this tunnel or up into the tunnel, you automatically get pulled into it. You don't have to do anything. You get drawn into it, and then you start a journey. At high speed, I've done, let's call it, scientific experiments on this. I've been up that pipe a couple of times to see how does it work and where does it go. So you travel at high speed through various phases. It takes about 3 days in Earth time to finally get to the place where you want to be, and then you are safely there. So I know Buddhists say you can reincarnate within 48 hours after actual breathing your last breath. In my experience, it takes about, record is 3 days to get there. And then once you're in the spirit world, it takes about, in earth time, on average, 3 months before you can then reappear on earth as a spirit, as an angel, as a guide, as anything for your grandchildren and so on, and whisper advice in their ears. So if your loved one has passed and you feel a complete hollowness in your heart, there's nothing there. It's as if a limb has been removed. Know that they've arrived. Because as long as they are still in the in-between phases on the way there, you can still be connected to them. As a matter of fact, you even have the power to hold them back and not let them through. That's where the rituals come in, is to let them go. And it's also about the grieving process. You need to let them go. It's more about those stayed behind than those that has died. They're happy. They're in a fantastic place. So don't keep the one that has passed back. Once that person is left, yes, you will feel absolutely hollow, but then the grieving process will assist you to start building up, and your family and friends and so on, pray will help you fill up and carry on with your life. So how do you do this transition? Very easily, very, very simple. Yamas and niyamas. You all know of yamas and niyamas. If you understand them, if you apply them, you cannot go wrong. If you believe in a God, no matter what God, there's only, everything is one anyway. Call it what you like. If you believe, for the atheist, if you believe that there must be something out there somewhere that is greater than me, that I would so show respect to, a high five to, you must be greater. I cannot make an ocean. Somebody made this ocean. There is something out there that's greater than me. If you can have within you respect for something greater than you, you will find it much easier to die. And then the final thing is peacefulness, shanti. Part of the ritual is chanting shanti, shanti, shanti. Why? Because shanti means peacefulness, a state of peacefulness, not as I understood peace. It's peacefulness, a state of being. Shanti, if you chant that, means may you experience that space of peacefulness while you are alive in the physical body, because that's what you want. That's the aim of life, as far as I'm concerned, is to be able to be peaceful in this turbulent existence and see if you can actually go into Turiya while you're alive. Just dip in there and come out. That's the aim of life. If you can do that, and when the day comes to cross over to the next dimension, it will be a breeze. It will be falling asleep in your sleep. Nothing to fear about death. Really, absolutely nothing to fear about death. But do know, and there I'm confronted with suicide and people saying, well, in that case, I'm having a terrible life. Why don't I just, as somebody said to me, press the reset button? It doesn't work like that. As long as you die due to natural causes, now a motor accident and so on is natural causes, things will go well. If you die at your own hand, a whole different set of sequences kicks in. You don't want to go there. I write about it. There's an entire chapter on suicide. And I have had people that read it that came to me and said, very suicidal, thanks to that chapter, I have not done that. So it has served its purpose. That's the last thing you want to do. Because why? You've got a duty. You've got a duty to serve. That is everybody's life path. You are here to serve. You are here to find out who you are. Serve yourself. Serve others. And through that process of understanding and learning, you eventually understand that there is not two. There is only one. And once you can get there, you're done. I don't think you need to come back. So the teachings that Gautam is teaching are extremely valuable. And I see my prayer is that you all understand it and it really sinks in, because it is your afterlife depends on it. I will open the floor to questions now, if there's questions.
So my sister is the one who brought me here. I've never come here before. And she has a question that I'm on behalf of her asking. She is of the understanding that our soul chooses our next life or, what it wants to do. In that case, she's saying, why does a soul choose self-destruction? If you want me to elaborate, self-destruction means choices that are, the soul or probably the person knows are destructive. Let's say alcoholism or let's say, gambling or let's say, any vices. So why does the soul choose that kind of a life?
I have worked with a lot of cases of drug abuse, which is, it has a terrible knock-on effect on family, on friends, on everybody. And the interesting part is, the drug abusers are normally the most highly advanced souls out there, according to me. So, what I have deducted from that experience is that it starts with, you got to sort yourself out. You do a few lifetimes where you discover yourself, you do service to self, and then you come back and you do a few lifetimes where it's service to others. The self-destructive person, it's not really about that person, it's about all the people around them, what that person is teaching everybody else. The patience, the forgiveness, the continuous assistance, and. So to me, the self-destructive person is actually the one who is sacrificing their body, their lifetime, for others to learn extremely valuable lessons from this experience.
Once we go beyond, right? Like, do we have a choice not to take birth?
Not to take birth? No.
No.
Well, that depends on what you do in life.
Okay.
That determines.
So you said almost 50 days you are in certain plane, right? On a certain plane. And during that time, you have better consciousness. You can sort things out. If you have learned something in this life. So during those 50 days, can you progress spiritually? And that can direct a better birth for a spiritual journey only? Or as we learn from Gautamji, everything is destined till you reach to the moksha.
No, you can't. No, you can't. The aim is to get to the in-between state. There should only be one goal, and that is to get out of here, to get out of this transitionary period where I am. You want to get to the in-between state. Okay, so the problem with the ability to see things and go shopping in Paris is that or you try and communicate with your loved one, but of course you cannot. It is two different dimensions. It is like you cannot dream and be awake at the same time. So the person who's dreaming cannot bring the awake person into the dream world with them. So the person who is outside of their body cannot communicate with the person who's in the body. Right, so you cannot make your peace and your things like that at all. That is senseless. You can hear them. By the way, you can help hear them argue over the inheritance and stuff that you didn't expect to hear. You can hear their thoughts, what they think about you, which you may not expect it. So my taking is you want to be out of there as quickly as possible. Okay, your loved ones maybe didn't love you as much as you think they did. Okay, so nothing can happen in that period.
I was just trying to reconcile the two schools in my head, which is Raja Yoga and Jnana Yoga, which is, for me, the main dichotomy seems to be that when I go down the path of Raja Yoga, it seems like I have to do a lot of things. I have to live my life a certain way, follow certain yamas and niyamas. I have to meditate. I have to basically quiet my mind. So there is a lot of doership involved over there. But when I, listen to Gautam and Roger, it's just the opposite. The only thing that I know is that I'm a product of my genetics and my upbringing. And so I should not have any attachment to outcomes or have a sense of doership. So for me, there is a conflict over there, because when I think about life from a Raja Yoga perspective, there is a system that somebody's put over there, and I need to do a certain number of things to reach salvation or enlightenment. Whereas if I, and for me personally, I align more closely to Jnana Yoga, is that the only thing I know is that I have had no control over my existence. So what I need to do is just make sure that whatever conditioning has been provided to me, I uncondition. And I let go of doership and attachment to outcomes. So how do you reconcile the two?
My take on this one is, and the man is sitting right next to me, the more you do, the less you need to do. The more you do, the less you need to do. So you've got to go through that doership thing so that you can realize that this is actually a silly idea. But you're not going to really realize it until you've suffered as a result of it. So I say do, yes. Do and do and do until you get it that you don't need to do. Otherwise you won't get it. So in my lifetime, for instance, previous lifetime, I did a lot. No cities, nothing happened. I couldn't understand why all this praying. Is it really worth it? What's the point of all of this? And died. This lifetime have done absolutely nothing, and I've got all the cities. So it comes eventually, but you've got to get to that point of realization.
Because you know, the only thing that I need to think through is that did you actually do anything in your past life, or did whoever put you over there made you do it? Which is consciousness. So I am a localization of consciousness, and whoever created the system is consciousness as well. So there's only consciousness. So did you actually do anything in your past life, or did whoever created you make you do that because you were supposed to do it?
Whoever created me made me do that, because, as you said right in the end. That is the, what do you call it, the circus of life, or the craziness that we do.
Yeah, and we are the monkeys also as part of that circus.
Absolutely.
But I just want to clarify one point. See, this Raja Yoga and Gyan Yoga. Now, Arjuna was trained to be a warrior, was born in a warrior caste. So his dharma was to fight, because he was designed that way. Some people are not designed that way. So if someone is designed to do, they will do many things, but they don't realize that it is not them, the ego, which is in charge of their doing. It is the force, the current, as Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi said. It is the current which is operating through them, making them do multiple things. But the ego comes in and says, I am the doer. So there's actually no conflict, because if your nature is to follow Gyan Yoga, you follow Gyan Yoga. If your nature is to follow Karma Yoga, you follow Karma Yoga. Bhakti Yoga, Raj Yoga. It depends on everyone's nature. It's not a one-size-fits-all. But as Lawrence says, because I know people in my own life who do so much, so much, so much, get constantly disappointed by the outcomes because they're never in their control, that they get exhausted finally. That is when the dawn of understanding happens, that I was never really the doer of my actions. But that is not everyone's destiny. And everyone is designed in a different way. So I honestly don't see any conflict here. The conflict happens when I am acting against my nature. Going against my inherent nature because of peer pressure, maybe what my family tells me, what society tells me, and then I suffer the consequences. And the entire Gita is only on this point. The ego deluded thinks I am the doer. And so when Krishna tells Arjuna to pick up the bow and fight, he says, you have assumed that you are the one killing your preceptors, whereas I, as time, have already killed them, and you are merely the instrument through whom the killing will happen.
You can ask more questions.
Hi. What role does grace play in all of this, merited or unmerited post-death? You spoke about niyams and yams and what one did and how one lived their life. So perhaps if you could maybe comment about where does grace come into all of this. Thank you.
I think, Gautam, you'll be better at this one.
I think grace is all there is. And it is everything. But there's a price. You see, grace depends on how much love, trust, and surrender there is. Then grace flows. If there's no love, trust, and surrender, then one is not even open to receiving grace. So grace is always ever there. But are we vehicles and receptive enough to receive it? You see, there's this famous incident between Yogi Krishnamurti and Ramana Maharshi, where it is believed Yogi told Bhagwan, "Can you give me enlightenment?" And Bhagwan replied, "But can you take it?" You see? So, the thing is, are we worthy of that grace? Now, at one level, you may say, if you're destined to have the grace, you will have it. But if I'm following a particular teacher, guru, or teaching, am I earnest? Am I sincere? Am I living it or trying my best to live it all the time? So I will know myself whether I'm worthy of receiving that grace. Grace is waiting to happen. You see, that is why... I mean, see, the whole Mahabharata was already a default setting because Arjuna had to choose Krishna. He basically chose grace because he said, I need nothing else. But then the mechanics of the ego had to work out the whole thing. That is what happened. But it was already a given that who would win the battle. So the grace is always there. See, there's this famous saying, someone asked Annamalai Swami, who was a disciple of Bhagwan, that... living near Arunachala does the job, because the Shiv Puran says if you're in a 30-mile radius, your job is done. But he said there's a misconception here, because living near it means having it in your heart all the time, thinking about it all the time, not just physically living near it. And then he gives the story of Ramakrishna Paramhans, where Ramakrishna says that there were these two guys, and one decided to go to a lecture on the Bhagavatam, and the other said, let's go to a prostitute. So the guy said, no, I'm going to the Bhagavatam, and this guy said, I'm going to the prostitute. Now when the guy went to the prostitute, did his job, the thought came, what a waste of time this was. If I had sat in the Bhagavatam, I would have been happier because I learned so many things from it. And his mind started going to the Bhagavatam. The guy who went to the Bhagavad lecture started thinking about the prostitute. That if I had gone there, I would have had much more fun. So what is the content of our consciousness? You see, that determines the grace. If we come to a teaching or teacher and we start seeing life through their lens, their prism, no matter how different it is from what we've been conditioned to. You know, like the American mystic Lester Levinson said, when in his 40s he was told he has 2 weeks to live because he had diseases of every conceivable kind, it struck him that he was wanting to be loved from everyone, family, friends, everyone. And he never thought of being loving himself. And so he said the minute he changed this around for himself and started loving others for who they were, no matter how they treated him, one by one, all his diseases vanished. Then he became a teacher in the West. So even this opening, you see, to receive grace, that needs to be part of the destiny on one level. But as Nisargadatta Maharaj said, your earnestness is the key. Then the grace will come.
Hi. I wanted to ask about spirit guides, angels. At what stage after death do they assume that that form, or and are they forever there? Do they transition back into another life? Because I hear and read about angels, spirit guides, that they are around you. Each person has their own. You just have to be able to recognize or come in touch with them. I don't know how. I mean, I suppose you have to be open to the energy, or I'm not sure how, but I was just curious about, are they always going to remain in that state? Will they ultimately take birth again? These angels or spirit guides who are often family members or of each person, you know, those who have transitioned earlier, say parents or grandparents, ancestors. And also, okay, that's a separate question maybe, or I don't know if it's the same, morphic fields, and about living in different dimensions and spheres. You spoke of a 3-month period, and there is there's the ghost stage.
1 month.
But 3 months also you spoke of. Sorry, I must have. Yeah, 30 days.
So you need to be out of here in a month's time, otherwise you go into the ghost world and be very clear about
okay, this. So in a month you are moving through whatever fields, I suppose, or dimension or space or whatever happens.
Okay. Yeah.
And then can you go off into this spirit world forever and remain an angel and a spirit guide, or do you ultimately then, do they take birth again?
Yes. Okay. Lots of questions. That's okay. But I get what you're saying. Just briefly. So once you're out of your body, it's not quite the spirit world. You're outside of your body, but you're not earthbound. And you've got 30 days in which to leave that existence in which you are. You feel 100%, everything is just perfect. You can see, hear, taste, everything, but they can't see you. So you cannot communicate with them, and you cannot communicate. You can't communicate with them, and they can't with you, unless you're clairvoyant. If you can see that spirit, they can see you. That's a different thing, but that is just those who have the cities to do that. Can see it. Anyway, so you're in the spirit for 30 days, then you need to get out of there. The longer you stay, the bigger the temptation to stay. And if you then don't leave, you become the ghost and you're stuck there for a very long time. If you do leave via this vortex or through prayers and guidance from the loved ones who's praying for you, you then go into a spirit world, okay, and you stay there. Remember, there's no really such thing as time. That's an earth-made concept, but in earth time, you then come back at some point. In the process of reincarnation. Now, if you're a spirit guide, you are somebody who is reincarnated so many times, you are actually qualified for moksha, but you decide, and even those in moksha decide to come back in some sort of a form to assist. Buddha's Atva concept.
In a
spiritual form, as the guardian angel or a spirit guide or something like that. I have, for instance, even found that if you're an engineer in a certain field, and there was an engineer who was an expert in that field and died, and is now in the spirit world, if you in the physical world, you're this engineer sitting with a certain challenge, the spirit engineer becomes aware that this physical engineer is struggling with the channels and cannot wait to just whisper wisdom, and it's try this, try that. So you will sit in front of your desk not knowing the answer, and suddenly the light will just go on, light bulb, and say, oh, let's try this. That thing is most probably a spirit guide, ex-engineer, who's whispered that into you. So there is communication with that. They love it when that happens. So you can, as a dead person, communicate with the living people. You can come as a spirit guide, and then this, even the spirit guide can then come in a physical form as well at the later stage, and that is where the Ramana Maharishis and all those people come from, is people who's really been at a very high level of existence, come to the physical body when it is absolutely necessary to do so. I hope that answers.
Have you written about this in your
book? Yes, there's a chapter on spirit guides and so on. In the book as well, I've designed it in a way. Firstly, I wrote it because I'm not big on reading, so I wrote it for people who do not read books. And I found that people who don't read books read that book. Okay, so there's a good promotion. Hopefully they'll start reading other books as well, and as a result, I hope the bug will bite. So I wrote it in a very, very simple manner and self-explanatory. I wrote it in the third person, so it's a novel. It's not me telling the story. It is someone else telling the story. And what I've done is I have separated the chapters in such a way that there's different departments, basically. So if you want to, you can use it as a manual. You can go back. What did you say about what happens when my dog dies or wild animals dies or my children? There's a whole chapter on why do children die and the sense behind all of that. And at the back of the book, there's an index saying, what did you say about dogs again? And you can go with number, you go to that page or that chapter. So you can just brush up on that. I've also written it in a way. It's taken me 6 years to write this book, by the way. It's not something that just happens. And I'm talking, but obviously channeled. That every time you reread the book, you read a different story. There's layers of wisdom in there. And whatever you're ready to hear, you will hear or experience. Next time around, a couple of years later, you pick up that book, you see, my word, what a book. So it's a journey. There's certain chapters that people skip because they're not supposed to read it. And if you read the whole book, then you know you're supposed to read all of it, and so on. So it's not just a book. It is way more than just a book.
You know, two incidents come to mind which I spoke about in the retreat. One was when Annamalai Swami was put in charge of building the buildings in the ashram. And he was very good at it. But Bhagwan was guiding him throughout. Like, ultimately, Annamalai Swami said, Bhagwan said not to mention a word to anyone that he was actually guiding Annamalai Swami. But at one stage, Annamalai Swami felt very proud of the work he had done. And he could see for himself the ego coming in. I made these buildings. And he saw this big, dark, black cloud around him at that time. And just then, Bhagwan walked towards Annamalai Swami. And this dark cloud left him. And the only thing which Bhagwan told Annamalai Swami was, when the high priest comes, the bad spirits flee. To me, what Ramana Maharshi was talking about is the darkness of one's own ego. This black smoke, this black dust cannot bear satsang. Because satsang is the journey to the self. So it is bound to flee. That is one thing which I recall. The other is when in I Am That, Nisargadatta Maharaj says, with no desires you are dead, full stop, but with low desires you are a ghost. And I pondered over this line 20 years ago. And I realized what he meant was, of course, with no desires, the game is up. That is why Ramakrishna When his wife told him, "What is this love for mangoes?" he said, "The day I stop having it, I'll be gone in 3 days." He needed that desire to keep him bound. But with low desires, you are a ghost, because as Lawrence said, you don't want to leave from here. You are unsatiated. Your appetite, your vasanas, sanskars, wants, needs are so strong that even, forget for physical items, even your need to be loved can be so strong, your need to be loved from certain people in your life, that once you drop the body, you're still here as a ghost to want to be loved by them. Am I right in that?
Absolutely.
Assumption?
And the problem is, once your 30 days are all over, everything changes. Then you don't get that love. And you can feel it while you're still in that in-between phase. But once that you become the ghost, you're a zombie. And you just hover around. And that's where grace also comes in. Gracefully, somebody will come around and tap your shoulder. I do that often when people ask me, so-and-so died. They want to know, has this person transitioned successfully? And everybody's not so lucky to have the 13-day ritual as your culture and life has. So I often, what I can do is I can go back to the moment of death and see then what happened and trace them. And then I can leave my body, become the ghost as well, in other words, so they can recognize me as one of them, and then communicate with them. Hold them by the hand and say, come, I'll take you out of here and take you where to go. So it is very possible that once you get into that ghost stage, you stay there for a long time until somebody like me or whatever grace leads you out of there again.
So the religion that I'm born in, they say that after you die, you can become even animal or a bird. So I just want you to tell us, is that true, or just human being, become a human being in next birth only? And my second question is, repeated numbers. When you see repeat numbers like 1111 or 555, does that mean anything, or it's just hyped up things?
Okay. The numbers is outside of my field of interest.
It's got nothing to do with death, I suppose.
It's got nothing to do with death.
Yes. No, I thought spirit and angel and all that. They say when you see those numbers, that means that angel is around you and giving you some hint if you have any question or if you are... That's okay.
Okay. Sorry, in the first part?
Our first part is after you die, do you become human being only?
Okay. You can become a rock if you like.
If you like.
You can come back as a rock. A rock is consciousness. A rock is energy. Yes. A rock has got all the elements. According to the Bhadu Todo, written by Padmasambhava, he wrote that book that was hidden for 400 years for a reason, because people were not ready for this. And then, even then, it was kept secret for a very long time before somebody found it and translated it, and now people can read it. And people are still not ready for that book, because that book says that there are various possibilities that you can go to, not just straight up moksha. And people are not ready to hear that because they become fearful. I think that is where the fear of death comes in. Oh, what if I go down the wrong tunnel? So what I do in my book is I emphasize that you must really, really try your best to overcome the temptation of distraction. Practice that in your life. If you decide on a goal, go for it. You will be distracted. Life is designed that way, to distract you off your path. Try and fight that, because once you're out of your body, yes, there is distraction. There are other side tunnels that can take you to the bird world or the cockroach world or whatever world is out there. And you can become that. Now, the aim is to go to the light, to go straight up. We want to end up in moksha. We don't want to come back. So what I share with people is one-pointed focus, no distraction. God is in the heavens somewhere at the top. I look up and I just go straight there. You will then not be distracted by looking sideways and what's going on in the party around you. And you just know, if you absolutely, because I don't mention these things in the book, because I don't want to distract people. If people can just believe in one thing, they will go to one thing. So, yes, it is possible, but no distraction will get you where you need to be.
There are two instances with Ramana Maharshi where two animals which came to him were reincarnations of his disciples to complete their journey. One is Lakshmi the cow, and the other is a white peacock, which they believed was the reincarnation of Madhava Swami. Because that same peacock, there used to be a bookshelf near Bhagwan. And his job, when he was alive, the disciples' job was to clean the bookshelf. And this peacock would go and peck at those same books and had many habits which he had. So they concluded he had come to complete his journey with Bhagwan. So I know there are different masters who say different things about this. Some say you can't go back and some say you can. Like Muktananda, Swami Muktananda of Ganeshpuri, there was a wild elephant which he tamed. And he said that this elephant was a yogi in a past life who was very hard to control or something like that. So we don't know. But that is why I say finally we must focus on our own sukha shanti and stay with that. Otherwise we can get lost in this conceptual world, you know.
This makes sense, yes.
And not to try our best not to hurt others, not to harm others.
Which reminds me, may I tell the story on how you got to publish the book? With Ramana and all that link. Just 2 or 3 years ago, I had a dream of a boy, 15, 16-year-old boy, walking up to me. I could sense he's a guru of sorts, saying he wanted to talk to me. And I said, okay, fine, let's talk, and I woke up. Now, what's the sense of having a dream like that? So lying in bed contemplating why the guru wants to talk to me, but then I wake up. Somebody phones me to say, do you know the Maha Kumbh Mela is on next year? Are you going? And that is where the gurus gather and they talk to people. So I thought, wow, this is, yes, Abu's a no-brainer. I'm going, I must go to the Kumbh. Now, in the meantime, I met a friend. I want my big mission. I've been all over. I've been to Kedarnath and Badrinath and everywhere around India. I had enormous experiences. My next movie is Kailash. But due to political reasons, things like that, it was very difficult to get there. So I had to give up on my dream on going to Kailash next. And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you go to Arunachala? That is kind of Kailash light. And then when I heard, okay, I'm going to the Kumbh, I phoned this guy and said, I'm coming to India, you know, why don't we go see your mountain? He then said, yeah, sure. And that was just happened to be a week before the Kumbh started. And he happened to be on a Gautam retreat that was there at the time. And he said, well, why don't you join us for the retreat? I said, okay, who's this Gautam fellow? I don't know. I don't know nothing about him. I didn't even check up on him. I just came. Of course, I came for the mountain. So just a few steps back. I had the sense that it was Sai Baba of Shirdi that was that guru. So I went on the internet and I looked at photos of what he looked like as a kid, and I saw, no, that's not the boy. So I gave up. I thought, oh, well, forgot about that. Get to Thiruvannamalai, meet Gautam, and maybe I could just add this story. I do apologize. I hope this is okay to say. When I met him, I thought, oh my, how am I going to stay awake in this fellow's teachings? Because he talks so slow. And then there's these silence patches. You know? Only to realize that his teachings is so powerful that if he goes faster, you won't get it. It will burn you out. So he's got to go slow, and those pauses is to give you, your consciousness, a chance to absorb and to process before you can carry on. So just as a matter of interest, and his teachings is all about burning ego and destroying the ego, killing the ego bit by bit. If your ego decides, no, I'm not going to be killed, I don't want to listen to what this fellow is saying, you're going to shut down and you're going to fall asleep. So if you fall asleep in the teaching, it shows that you're not quite ready, your ego doesn't want to get involved, So therefore, it is essential. And that came to me, fortunately, while I was listening to you. That I can't. I'm not allowed to fall asleep in this guy's sleep. Think about that when you hear. Is if you fall asleep, just say ego. You're getting burned today. You're getting destroyed today. You stay awake, and you slowly you take in what you can. Just as a side note. So I'm listening to the person. I'm not falling asleep. And I hear about Ramana Maharishi Ashram. Everybody says, you've got to go to this ashram. I know of Ramana. I've never done anything in line with his teachings. So I go to the ashram, and there I walk in. What do I see? A big painting or drawing photo of him as a boy, and that's the guy in the dream. So I said, okay, I was supposed to come here, not the Kum, but now I've already booked for an entire month at the Kum. So I was there. That was now quite interesting. Then it so happened that Gautam gets hand on the book, and we meet at the Kum, and he suggests that they publish the book, and we agree, and it takes a couple of months to get all the administration done. They sign a contract, post it to me, because you've got to do it on a physical paper. I signed the contract, and it just so happened, I checked the date afterwards only, I signed the contract on the 14th of April, which is the day that Ramana himself died, for those who know. And what is the title of the book? When you die. You cannot make these things up. So, there's, I think, Ramana himself has had a hand in telling this message of do not fear, be focused, one point in focus. And it's only after I've been introduced to Advaita, I reread this book and I thought, this is Advaita. So, yes, there is definitely a correlation there.
Jai Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Pyari. Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Pyari. Ekadanta Ati Vishala Shobhita Sindhura Bhala. Ekadanta Ati Vishala Shobhita Sindhura Bhala. Motiyanaki Kanthamala. Motiyanaki Kanthamala. Nenaratnari. Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Pyari.
Thank you.